Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Today we have a great guest with us today, Dr. Jay Richards. I'm going to give his long bio here in a second because I think it's, I want to read this one. I a lot of times skip through him. I want to give this one full credit for what he's done in his life so far. But we're going to be talking about COVID, more particularly the response to COVID, and specifically the Catholic Church's response to COVID, focused mostly on America. I mean, I know every country was a little different, but we're going to focus mostly on the United States. So Dr. Jay Richards is the recently named William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow in Heritage Foundation's DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society. That's a mouthful, but congratulations, because this is a very new appointment, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's just happened. In fact, I haven't even started full time. So it just was announced, actually.
Okay, well, congratulations. So
thanks.
And so you come from Heritage from Catholic University, where you served, mm-hmm. where Dr. Richards served as a research assistant professor in the Bush School of Business and the academic content lead for the Tucson Project at the Catholic University of America. He's also a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and executive editor of The Stream. And by the way, Crisis is a very big fan of The Stream, so keep up the good work there as well. And I encourage everybody to read The Stream. I kind of joke that my wife, she reads The Stream more than she reads Crisis, so that's okay.
Well, we have more articles, so that's fair.
That's true. Yeah. That's what I'll say. That'll make me feel better. So big fan of The Stream, though, here. Jay has a PhD with honors in philosophy and theology from Princeton Theological Seminary. He has an MDiv and a Master of Theology and a BA with majors in political science and religion. He lives in the Washington, D.C. area, metro area. He's an author of many books, and I was joking with him before we came on that at one point, my wife was reading his book on the bedside table. I was reading another book of his, so we had the Jay Richards hour before bedtime each night. The most recent, which is the one I was reading at the time, is The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. It's co-authored with William Briggs and Douglas Axe, and explores the government, media, and social response to the COVID pandemic. That's the reason we're talking today. Also, you're a lay Dominican, I see, and a convert to Catholicism. So after all that, welcome very much, Jay, to the program.
Well, it's great to be with you, Eric. Thanks so much.
So I wanted, before we get into the details of the COVID response and all that, I just wanted to ask, I did not realize until literally I was doing your bio for this program that you're a convert. Can you tell a little bit about why you became Catholic, with the story behind that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I grew up Presbyterian, actually, and my wife grew up Wesleyan evangelical. We're basically, sort of mainstream evangelicals. We're going to a Presbyterian church. And honestly, if you asked me 15 years ago, I didn't have any plans to become Catholic. But when I was working at the Acton Institute, I had lots of friends that were Catholic that were frankly very engaging. And even though I had been to seminary, even though I'd studied these issues, I really had not studied the doctrinal issues that separated Catholics from Protestants in the kind of detail I thought they deserved. You know, of course, I knew the Reformed answer to every Catholic view, but that's different from actually studying the Catholic arguments. And so I actually, as a type of thing only, I suppose, a philosopher would do, I actually made a list of what I call doctrinal impediments. So the things that I thought were sort of the big doctrinal issues, and I put canonization and authority at the top, and then the doctrine of the real presence and the doctrine of justification and things like that. And then the Marian dogmas at the very bottom, because I thought I'm never going to get to those. Those are so exotic when you're Protestant. I don't know.
That was last on my list when I converted too, by the way.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know what to do with that. You know, the assumption of Mary, what is this? But actually, I had already come around to more or less, I would say, a Catholic, or really what I think was the kind of classical perennial understanding of justification, even as a Protestant. I thought that Calvin and Luther had gotten kind of way off on an extreme and didn't represent either the biblical witness or the tradition. But honestly, real presence was obscure to me, frankly. And then the question about sola scriptura and church authority. And so the nice thing is I ask friends, okay, who are the best Protestants on these particular topics? And then for the Catholics, I would just go and read the online Catholic encyclopedia, which is actually really useful. You know, there isn't a thing like that for Protestants. Like, okay, I'll just read the Catholic encyclopedia from 1910 on the real presence and see what it says. And okay, I'm going to really, you know, do my best to know, okay, I want the representative argument from people that believe these. And frankly, I found them persuasive. I found the critiques of sola scriptura very persuasive. I was already kind of aware of the philosophical problems, but I found the Catholic answer to that very satisfying intellectually. I was utterly persuaded that the church had believed and taught the real presence. I thought the exegesis of John 6 and the relevant passages didn't really make any sense unless you affirmed the real presence. And honestly, by the time I had worked through those big issues, the Marian dogmas, they fall into place because they fit the larger picture. And so those ended up not being the impediment I thought they would be. My wife wasn't really going through the process at the same rate I was, but she had already, for different reasons, been attracted to the Catholic Church for a long time. I joke that she was one Scott Hahn book and a conversation with somebody other than me away from becoming Catholic, you know, for years. And so we actually entered the church as a family, guess what, is about 12 and a half years ago now. My daughters were young enough that they actually entered with us. My younger daughter, who's now just graduated from high school, she's the only one that's sort of psychologically a cradle Catholic. But I managed to raise liturgy snobs despite my best efforts not to do that. But, you know, it's sort of how these things happen. And so it's been an amazing journey. And, you know, at the time I thought, you know, I don't know how this will go. But because of the fact that my career was mostly as a public Christian, I wasn't trying to be specifically Protestant or Catholic. I've been able to do a lot of what I was doing before and continue to do those things. It's really been a blessing for me. It's different than if, you know, have friends who are Protestant pastors. You become Catholic, that, you know, it's like, okay, what do? That's tough. For me, actually, as a public intellectual and a writer and academic, it hasn't suffered the kind of transition cost that a lot of people had. And it's been a lot of the great blessings. I could tell you, a Catholic friend of mine, the day we entered the church, wrote me, I won't give his name. Listeners of viewers would probably recognize it. He said, "Jay, welcome to the church. Now our problems are your problems as well."
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Well, welcome after 12 years to the church. And I was going to ask, so the Heritage Foundation, I know we're going to get over here in a second, but I, of course, think of that from my days as an evangelical, because it's been around forever, as a very Protestant organization. But obviously, they're willing to hire you. So I assume then for the issues that you're talking about and dealing with, being Catholic doesn't pose any issues to the Heritage Foundation? I mean, it seems obvious.
But the Heritage has actually always been, I mean, very ecumenical. So it's not a specifically religious organization. But if you think about Ed Fulner, who founded it, he was actually Catholic. Ryan Anderson, who had the William E. Simon, this position before I did, he left to go to the Ethics and Public Policy Center to be its president. He's Catholic. It's an amazing mix of different people. There's lots of Protestants and evangelicals. My colleagues in the DeVos Center are evangelicals. And we come together. I mean, this has been a big deal for me for a long time. It's one of the reasons James Robinson and I started the stream, is that we were convinced that, like, Christians, as Christians, we ought to be able to bring our specific convictions to the public square. At the same time, if Catholics and evangelicals can't figure out how to work together to preserve our culture and to preserve the American experiment, then there really isn't any hope. And so I felt like that was a part of my own personal mission for a long time. And I think that Heritage is really a flagship conservative organization that's doing that. And it's managed to maintain its defense of good economic policy, as well as the so-called social issues that a lot of other organizations, you know, it's like, oh gosh, marriage is too hard to argue about. Let's not talk about that. Let's not talk about the transgender issue. Heritage has managed to maintain all of those things. And so I'm really excited to be joining Heritage at this. It's a fraught moment, but I, like my friend Austin Roos says, there's no finer time to be a Catholic. There's no finer time to be a public Christian, because we have a lot of opportunities, I think, to make a difference.
That's right. That's right. We had Austin on a couple months ago. So, okay. So now let's get to the topic at hand. I want to ask you, when COVID first happened, so we're talking February, March, beginning of March, 2020, what was your initial reaction? Like, how did you first kind of think about it? And going right into the beginning of the lockdowns, what did you think about it at that point?
So early, I would say in February, I was sort of tracking it and didn't really know what to think. Of course, like everyone else, we heard, okay, there's this dangerous virus. It's starting to spread. We went, my family and I took these kind of rare family vacations. It was just a vacation for the sake of a trip. Wasn't connected to a public speech. We went to the Bahamas. That was in early March because that's when spring break was. And we were wiping everything down. My wife was doing her, you know, the kind of homeschool mom, build it yourself, hand sanitizer thing, you know, doing the whole deal because we just really didn't know what to think. And so then we got back. Things started immediately locked down just a few days after we returned. And I started looking into the details. And I realized that the public health response was not actually based on data that we had about this virus or the infection fatality rate. We were taking our cues from this now infamous model by the Imperial College London that predicted, you know, 2.2 million Americans would be dead within a few months, infection fatality rate of 3.4%. This model was led by this guy, Neil Ferguson, who has a terrible record of 20 years of disastrous predictions based on these speculative statistical models. And I realized, hey, this is a bad thing because we're responding to something that we actually, as if it's one thing, and we don't actually have any reason to think that that's what it is. And very quickly, I think into April, I realized, this is not actually what we're being told. And that's why Doug Axe and William Briggs and I sort of independently were worried about it and decided, okay, maybe somebody's got to be the first one to write a book about this to prevent the lockdowns the second time. That's why we really wrote the book. And so, but right in the beginning, it's not like I'm a virus skeptic, you know, if it was Ebola or something, I didn't have any preconceived notions that you can't have a deadly virus. It was just the details of this and the dependence on this speculative computer model, that the thing that I guess tipped me and made me think, okay, this is a disaster. And so that I was talking about it and criticizing it publicly at a time when most of my friends thought, Jay, you know, talk about this. Are you crazy? You know, a few months later, they said, okay, I see what you're saying. But it was really all three of us that wrote The Price of Panic were acutely aware of the mischief of speculative computer models, and they haven't been tested against the empirical evidence. And so I think that's honestly what just made us much more skeptical early on than a lot of people.
Yeah, and it's amazing how much those models were accepted as gospel truth. Mm-hmm. I remember I'd be on Twitter and I was slower than you, I think, in kind of seeing the narrative wasn't really working. But I remember when I started to just kind of slightly come out, this was maybe into March, early April, and be like, you know, this seems to be like, I was always against the lockdowns from day one.
Yeah.
But because that's more of a liberty thing than anything else. But right. Like this, the virus, the models, I was like, well, I don't know. Maybe the model, I mean, what do I know? I'm not a modeler or anything like that. But I remember if I even suggested that perhaps we shouldn't do X, whatever the Fauci or whoever was saying, I would just get people hammering, like, you want 2 million dead? You want 2 million dead? I mean, the right. 2 million dead was just like hammered at us back. And that all just came from Ferguson's model, right?
Entirely. I mean, and so Dr. Fauci told President Trump at the time, because Trump told us in April, they said, why did you advise lockdowns? And he said, two very smart people came into my office and said, Mr. President, 2.2 million Americans are going to die if we don't shut everything down. And so we shut everything down. That number, that the only basis for that number was the Imperial College London model. There wasn't another basis for that number. It was, and that itself was based upon this assumption they had about the infection fatality rate that ended up being off by orders of magnitude. So that now by April the 7th, we were aghast because we realized, okay, the actual empirical data that we're getting here from Italy and places like that, it was quite clear that it was a very discriminating virus. It tended to kill people that were very close to the end of their natural lives and not tend to affect people that are young. That we knew there's no way that infection fatality rate was right, but I tracked it. And Eric, even in June, if you Googled what's the IFR of COVID-19 virus, Google told you it was 3.4%. So, I mean, that's much of the story, is how this very thin wafer of evidence, right, or just this one little sort of claim could become internationalized so that the social media giants and the World Health Organization and the CDC and every CDC equivalent immediately moved on these marching orders based on such thin evidence. That's the thing that I think most people have a hard time psychologically grasping that. Like, how could all these smart people all around the world simultaneously act on so little evidence? Well, that's that, the answer to that question, I think, is the key answer and the key question to ask and to answer about this whole thing. Because I think that what the real story is really not so much about this virus. The real story is the social contagion, the role of social media and the media and the public health bureaucracies and their capacity to basically control the world so much so that they can shut down churches and immediately do it. That's what the story of 2020 is about.
Yeah. And what's amazing also is we saw big tech just jumped in full force with the narrative. And what's amazing is how much we've seen as of now in June of 2021, you can say things now and it's fine. Jon Stewart can make jokes about it. But if you literally said it a couple months ago, you're completely canceled and Facebook will delete your account, will just get rid of you because and act like you don't exist because you're a conspiracy theorist. And yet now we're like, oh, yeah, that's true. But there's no like, oh, maybe we shouldn't have done that. They're just continuing whatever the narrative is. They just stick to it. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And have you seen that? Like I was one thing I was wondering about is the price of panic with marketing it, talking about it. Have you or any of your co-authors, like, have you had cases where big tech has banned you, silenced you, kept you guys from saying what you're saying?
And so a couple of times there would be search problems with the book. So you could actually type the price of panic into Google or even Amazon, which the first print run, by the way, sold out in a few weeks. It was sort of That's unanticipated. But, you know, there'd be weird things like that, but you can't really prove, okay, are they sort of shadow banning this? Right. But I had an interview with my friend Bill Walton, a video podcast like this one, in which we talked about these things. And it got pulled up from YouTube. And in fact, it was doing really well. And then they immediately pulled it from YouTube. So then he took a bunch of time to put it on another, I'm trying to remember another video platform, which immediately pulled it as well. It was the craziest thing. And then I think it was right after the election, then it suddenly reappeared. And so they pulled it because it violated, you know, it was actually the policy they said that it violated was that was encouragement for self-harm. So if a video encouraged people to harm themselves, so they're basically implying we were encouraging suicide, so far as I could tell, which is, of course, just completely baseless. That was as bad as it got. My co-author, William Briggs, got suspended a couple of times from Twitter talking about these things. But that's honestly about as bad as it got for us. The book hasn't been banned like Ryan Anderson's transgender right. book or anything like that. And so in some ways, we're just right on the edge, though, I would say. And part of it is that, you know, I mean, it happened with Alex Berenson's little e-books that he would have trouble on these things. But I mean, it really was quite creepy to watch how quickly the big tech folks just immediately decided they're going to be the experts or they're going to just rely on some particular expert. That was what was so weird. So Anthony Fauci, for instance, he is the designated expert for Google and for YouTube, but not Jay Bhattacharya, right? Not Martin Kulldorff at Harvard, right? Not people at Yale or Harvard or Stanford or Oxford that are as equally reputable. They were independent. So essentially the criterion was you needed to be a government official or a public health official in order to sort of have standing in this. And as we learned very quickly in analyzing this, actually public health officials have perverse incentives. Their incentive is always going to be to basically overplay their hand and to claim it's a disaster, because if it's not as bad as they say it was going to be, people will be, well, good thing it wasn't so bad, or good thing we did what we did. If on the other hand, they say it's not going to be any big deal, well, they're going to lose their jobs. And so that's the problem. You never know with the public health officials what their incentives are. Whereas if you're just a professor that knows the details of epidemiology and you're at Stanford Medical School, but you're independent of the government public health bureaucracy, actually your testimony should count for more because your incentives are going to be less perverse than the public health people. But Google and the social media and media decided, no, it's going to be these public health people, as if being a member of the public health bureaucracy is like winning the gold medal in the science Olympics or something. You know? That doesn't confer on them any particular authority when it comes to the evidence.
Yeah, I can't imagine the best. I mean, the best and the brightest aren't usually the ones attracted to government work anyway. But apologies to anybody who works in the government who's watching this right now. I mean, it just, you know, the idea that the incentive that was something I noticed at the beginning was that they can't go wrong. There's no downside for them for overreacting.
That's right.
But there is a huge downside if they underwrite. If it really is a 3.4% and contagious rate that's just ridiculous and all of that stuff, and people are dying on the streets and they did nothing, well, they're going to be the first ones who are hanged.
Exactly.
We realize that there are incentives for them to always overestimate.
Always. And that's what they always do. That's what Neil Ferguson has always done on these things, you know, and I think it was the bird flu in which, you know, these numbers in the tens or hundreds of millions of deaths when it ended up being dozens, you know, once all told. And so that's, I mean, many, many orders of magnitude off, but never manages to get punished or to find any problems, you know, encounter any problems with his career trajectory because of that. And so that's why I think political leaders that are getting the advice from people like this, they should ignore them, but they should also think, okay, what is their incentive? Let me take account of their incentive. The one politician that seemed to grasp this, unfortunately, it was not the president. It was the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, who figured out very quickly, okay, I've got my public health people here, but I'm going to talk to some scientists that are dealing with this on the front lines in Europe and listen to what they have to say. And he was able to very quickly pivot. And so in some ways, if you think about it, we have 50 governors and we had a president. It was hard enough that really only one or two or three, I think, managed to respond properly. And so that's why I think we need to use this as a lesson so that we don't do it again. And part of that is understanding the incentives of the public health bureaucracy so that politicians will, frankly, properly discount the advice that they're given from these people.
Right. And I was impressed. What I'm most impressed with DeSantis was is that he initially did lock down.
That's right.
What I thought was very admirable in him, and this is not found in very many politicians, is he was basically willing to say, I was wrong. And a lot of them just, like here in Ohio, our Republican governor, he just doubled down. And he never wanted to admit that basically, okay, all his information he was using to make his decisions was fatally flawed. And yet he just kept it up until basically he was kind of forced to finally end the different mandates here. But so I, you know, but as you can tell, when you can name how many did well in like one hand, that tells you how poorly the overall response was. I wish DeSantis had talked to Trump a little more to get rid of Fauci before Trump had left. And it just, I don't know why he kept him on and all those jokers.
Well, this is the promise, of course, presidents have and politicians have incentives as well. And so the public health bureaucracy, these aren't people that the president hires. They're people he inherits, right? Fauci's been there for decades. And nobody expected Trump to be a sort of public health expert. And he got in a really weird position because the media decided to make Fauci this celebrated cause, right? And so that he's this hero all of a sudden. It's like he could no wrong. He was this sort of infallible oracle. So that the president ended up in this awkward position, whereas I think inside he thought, I don't know that I should trust this guy, but if I go against him, right, I'm going to be the guy, the science, the president that went against the science. And so I think he'd had a hard time sort of recovering from just that kind of dilemma, even though I think his instincts were started out good and I think ended up good. But it took a long time to get people, you know, like Scott Atlas, who should have been in the White House this week too. Instead, it was months later that he actually started getting his advice. And so I think that's just the kind of reality of it. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that this happened in most countries. So this wasn't just an American problem. Right. This has happened certainly in all of the Anglosphere has been just insane. Unfortunately, there've been a few countries for sub-Saharan Africa was in many cases less insane. But the Anglosphere has just been almost entirely crazy. And so you end up just talking about a handful of countries like Sweden that didn't go completely overboard.
Right. Right. Now let's pivot now to the Catholic Church's response to this. As we mentioned, the narrative was very dominant in March, April. I mean, it basically, if I remember when a local evangelical church here had a service on Easter, which is in April of this 2020, and the governor literally, who is a professing Catholic, literally publicly shamed that one church in the Cincinnati area for daring to have a service, because he actually never made it illegal here. And that's one thing I want to talk about is the fact that
okay.
he never made it illegal to have church services, because he, okay. he knew that he was in constitutionally shaky ground there. But what he did was he used his bully pulpit to yes. shame this one evangelical church. And so this was the narrative, you know, all the push. And the Catholic bishops, without exception in America, all basically caved. And so mm-hmm. and locked down, shut down the churches, things like that. What were you thinking when this was going on about how the church, the Catholic Church, reacted to that when all our churches were locked down?
I honestly thought it was a disaster and said so at the time, because, of course, the argument, here's kind of the theological argument, is that, of course, we have a responsibility to the common good. If I'm doing something and we exercise my freedom that costs somebody else their health or their life, then, you know, that should condition what I do. And so that, yeah, that argument sort of makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's based on several assumptions, though. It's based upon a certain kind of deadliness of the virus is one. And then there's just the kind of basic constitutional issue that even if churches should respond, it doesn't follow that they should buckle under to civil authorities who decide that you're not allowed to go to church. I think that even if churches had decided, okay, we're going to start separating people in the pews or whatever, they first should have immediately sued the relevant governor or mayor to demand their rights as churches. They did not do that. And so it ended up being, for the most part, isolated evangelical churches, one Baptist church here in Washington, D.C., who fought the mayor, and they won because they fought them. But what happened all around the country is that dioceses and archdioceses didn't do that. And so Washington, I mean, the Basilica, for instance, the National Basilica, which can seat 6,000 in its upper church, was restricted by Washington, D.C. to 50 people for months and months and months and months. And it took, I don't know how long. It was, seems like it was the fall before the archdiocese got around to complaining and getting that partially lifted. And so my view is that even if certain kinds of restrictions on activities had been a kind of prudential thing to do, the churches still should not have participated in the kind of implication that the mayors had the authority to say, you're not going to celebrate mass. They don't have that authority. And that was what, to me, it made me so frustrated about this. And also the kind of naive acceptance that, well, if it's couched in public health terms, then we simply have to do it. What do we think is going to happen in the future? Do we think that oppression of the churches and the hostile forces of the churches are going to appeal what? To, you know, to our conscience or something like that, or appeal to worship of Satan? Of course not. You're going to say you need to shut down your churches because you're a danger to public health. Every attempt to exercise, I think, over-exercise the authority of the state that we will deal with in the next 20 years, I predict, is going to have some kind of public health angle, precisely because everyone now knows we will immediately submit as long as it's framed in terms of public health. That's a lesson that every would-be despot and tyrant now knows is true, that we're willing to buckle under, the church hierarchy is willing to buckle under. So why wouldn't they try this again?
Yeah, it was fascinating. Whenever you try to compare the tyrannical rule that occurred during COVID tide to any past tyranny, the immediate response of the defenders would be like, well, they were doing it for bad reasons, we're doing it for good reasons.
Yeah.
But my first thought is, well, you know, back then they said it was for good reasons, right?
Always. It's always.
It's not like they said, okay, we're going to lock everybody down and make you miserable. It's not like, Hitler said, okay, we're going to do all this because we're evil. No, he was saying because this is best for the German people. This is best for the
Absolutely. It's
always defended by the common good. I mean, if there's Absolutely. One thing communism is, it defends itself. It's defenders do. It's for the common good. I mean, every evil in Stalinistic Russia was for the common good. So
absolutely,
it's crazy how that's not seen as a clear thing. And I thought it was interesting that one thing that was interesting was there was just the fringe groups, basically, because this that defied it. Like this evangelical church was already known as kind of a oddball evangelical church in the area, and they had already had a bad reputation in the eyes of the elite. And so it wasn't surprising they stood up. There was a Sedi Vacantinist church in our town, mm-hmm. and they also refused to shut down. They, they were on the news for it and stuff, but they're like, no, I got a friend who goes there. And he was just like, no, we didn't shut down. You know, I think up in New Jersey, it's SSPX and an Orthodox Jewish group got together to sue. I mean, it's like, you know, strange bedfellows there. It's like, you know,
well, it does. And there's, I think there's a sociological lesson there, Eric, because if you are already sort of, you already steeled yourself to resist some whatever the popular thing is, right? Or be the odd person out. There's that sort of gives you a, there's a survival advantage when you get social, there's a social contagion. I think it's sort of like, you know, if for whatever reason, maybe you have a genetic propensity not to have sort of respond to social cues, you know, maybe you're on the autism spectrum, but you know, during a social contagion, that's actually really good because you're able to resist the social cues. And that's the sort of irony. And that's why it's so frustrating. Yeah. It was obvious. It very often it was sort of oddball groups that were willing to resist it, but they were right to do so. So the rest of us need to man up, and we need to figure out, okay, how can we be discerning so that the next time there's a social contagion, we're just not just carried along and don't just come up with theological justifications to do what everybody's telling us to do and have the capacity to build up resistant and antibodies to these social contagions.
Now, so after the lockdowns, I think most, at least regular Catholics, recognize that the shutting down of mass for 2 months or more was just terrible. But then a lot of those same people, they're very supportive of things like the mask mandates at mass and things like that. And the argument is it's not that big a deal. So what would be your response to the idea of masking at mass particularly, not just in different other settings, but particularly going to mass where you have to wear a mask in order to attend? How would you respond to the argument like, oh, it's not that big a deal. Just put the damn mask on.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm at least initially was sort of in a divided mind, because certainly, okay, if all I have to do is put this surgical mask on and I can go to mass, then, you know, it's sort of, I'm going to be kind of utilitarian about that.
Right.
But at the same time, let's look into the details of mask wearing. And when you realize, okay, first of all, this is not getting spread by droplets. It's getting spread by aerosols. The World Health Organization already did a meta study in October of 2019 that said mask wearing isn't going to do any good. When you see how people actually wear it, you know, it's not going to do any good. And so after this dragged on for a few months, it became quite clear that it was basically really just designed as a token, a kind of visible sign of compliance with the authorities that had nothing to do with anything. More significant than the mask was the lockdowns themselves, because I mean, that's why we wrote the book, Eric, is because the idea that population-wide lockdowns is how you're supposed to respond to a viral pandemic, it is not based on anything but it started as a high school science experiment that worked its way into the public health bureaucracy in the 2000s. It completely contradicted the pre-existing wisdom, which is that you isolate and quarantine sick people, the people that are both infected and sick, and then you protect the people that are most vulnerable, but you don't make everybody lock down. In fact, that might make it worse because you're forcing everyone inside together. And so that was what was really sort of outrageous, is that everyone just sort of accepted that, well, yeah, of course, the lockdowns is what you're supposed to do, when the World Health Organization itself had told us in October of 2019 that lockdowns would be a bad idea for a respiratory virus. And so that's when I realized this is just insanity. It's just planet-wide social insanity in which they're basically putting people under house arrest for no good reason. And I think we showed that in the book. We had data by the few months out that showed there's no connection between the date of lockdowns and a reduction in cases or deaths. The virus just could have cared less about those government-imposed lockdowns. No one wanted to sort of deal with that. No one wanted to deal with that reality that those things just don't work. The lockdowns don't work. Once we had suffered them, we didn't want to have to, you know, sort of go back and, okay, look, all that disaster that caused 40 million jobless, that was a bad idea.
Right. I don't know if you've seen, but Tom Woods has this this hilarious website. I don't think it's meant to be hilarious, but it's like something about COVID charts or something like that. And basically it gives you a quiz of charts. And it says, okay, pick the one, it'll have like maybe four states. It'll say, pick the one that ended the lockdown the earliest. And of course, you can't tell on any of these charts, you're gonna score zero other than just dumb luck, because every single chart, there's literally no way to say when the lockdown started, which ones had lockdowns. I mean, they just had no effect whatsoever, if anything, even a negative effect, but just no real effect to what was going on. And so it just is amazing. Now, Okay, so as a Catholic, though, here, let's really get to the Catholic point is a big argument was obedience. That, okay, you know, so here you are, you've done the research. You know lockdowns are stupid. You know they don't have any impact. There's no reason why churches should be locked down. There's really no reason for most of the different like rules about communion in the hand and all the holy water. The holy water font is the funniest one for me because like there was no evidence at all that that would do anything. But yet knowing that as a Catholic, I heard the argument over and over again, you still should obey the bishop in this because he has the rightful authority. So even though you know it's stupid and it's all theater, what would you say to that as far as like, okay, the argument from obedience of, are you being disobedient by saying the bishops were wrong to do this or even maybe going to a church and not following the rules that they give?
Well, if I'm a priest, and so, I mean, I think there's a different rule for a lay person who is genuinely expert on the subject or has studied up on it. Sorry, but bishops aren't experts on epidemiology, you know, and nobody thinks that, right? And so if you're a lay expert, that's sort of one thing. Now, I do think if you're a priest, you know, all things being equal, you're supposed to listen to the advice of your bishop. At the same time, we should have been going to bishops and telling them that this is stupid. We should have been doing everything that we actually could do. What I did was write and speak on it as much as possible and talk to relevant authorities behind the scenes. We should have absolutely been doing that. What I think happened is that we didn't have the kind of proper amount of pressure. And frankly, we didn't have the proper amount of discernment in the hierarchy to actually understand how to respond to this. I think that's what we really ought to take from this is, okay, we messed this up the first time. We actually don't know how to respond when we're told we need to shut mass down for public health reasons. Now let's get used to that because that's what they're going to try next year. Because the exact same argument for shutting down mass for COVID works for shutting down mass for the cold and flu season and almost anything else you want. Because anytime you leave the house, you're putting yourself and somebody else at risk. And so in principle, if people can use that argument to shut down mass, there's no reason not to be able to shut it down permanently. So we need to figure out, okay, so what are our arguments for why that's inappropriate and why we have a right to resist and we ought to resist?
It's somewhat of a perverse way they're going to do it too, because they say we have to shut down because there's a 3.4% fatality rate is one of the big reasons. And then we find out there isn't, and it's much closer to the flu. And so next time they're going to say, we're going to shut down for the flu because we shut down because of COVID, which is a similar to flu fatality rate. It goes back both ways for them.
It's going to go. That's right. It ends up being the kind of reduction to the absurd. You say, well, we wouldn't do this for the flu. And they say, well, that's a good point. I guess we should.
Yeah. So what would you then say if a bishop, I mean, I wish this would happen, came to you and said, what should I do when the whole world is telling me that I am killing grandma if I don't shut down the parishes? How should I respond to that? And because you know what will happen? One person will die. There will be somebody who dies who they found went to mass at some point. They don't have to connect that it was going to mass that caused it. It's just if somebody who actually went to mass ever died after that, they're going to say it's because this bishop killed them. So how would you say they should respond to that? And how should they stand up to those type of arguments?
They should do exactly the same thing that Ron DeSantis did. Ron DeSantis is just a secular governor of a populous southern state. He managed to do it, right? He had people saying he was killing everyone, and he just weathered the storm. He insisted on good data. The majority of the people of Florida were absolutely elated by it, and I think that would be the response in this case. Yeah, you'd have some attacks like that, but the reality is that sometimes you have to just, that's a mortification of the flesh. And in this case, it would just be the social opprobrium of all the officially smart people. But I think in that case, if a bishop has done his homework, he would have done the right thing. And so unfortunately, I don't think that happened. And I think, we just weren't prepared for it the first time. This really is the first time anything like this has ever happened. So what I really hope will happen is that we will be prepared for it. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops will be prepared to deal with real or bogus appeals to public health that will call us to shut down mass and limit numbers of mass, all those kinds of things. Let's at least use this as a lesson for what to do next time. Even if you say, okay, we'll forgive and forget 2020, but let's absolutely not do this again in 2022.
Yeah, I often say that give everybody a pass for whatever they thought or did in March or April of 2020, because there was a lot of just crazy information and a lot of people just didn't see it. And I get that. But now we do know. Now we do know that this is going to be used. What do you think will be, do you think this winter, for example, when our typical cold and flu season happens, do you think there'll be calls for shutting down different services, including mass?
Yeah, I do. I mean, this will, because of the fact that COVID sort of landed at a particular time in the calendar, it didn't perfectly track regular cold and flu season. I think what will happen is that this is going to sync up with the regular cold and flu season, which is seasonal. It basically correlates to when it's cold outside, there's not a lot of sun in the sky and people are cooped up inside and we're spreading these viruses around. And so I think what's happened now, the cat's out of the bag, this kind of argument can be used to justify basically, you know, closing religious services. And so at the moment, it's not like there were mass protests that would vastly disincentivize this. And so I suspect we'll see more of this. And I think we'll also see public health appeals for other things. I don't know if it'll be climate change or some other public health thing, but as long as it's framed in terms of public health, it's quite clear that most of us we're just not prepared to respond to that. We're prepared to say, I will fight to defend my freedom to exercise my faith. We're not prepared to say, well, what if exercising your faith causes you to kill the 80-year-old man in front of you, right? Well, how do you respond to that? Well, that's what we got to get used to responding to because that's kind of the moral jujitsu, right? It's one thing to say, well, you're infringing on my rights. It's another thing for them to say, no, you're infringing on the health and the rights of other people by exercising your faith. And so that's what I think we have to learn to respond to.
So what would be the response? So I'm just an average Catholic. I just want to go to Mass. I'm being told this, let's say this winter, that going to Mass is going to potentially put your neighbor at risk, and therefore it's not loving your neighbor. It's not for the common good. All those arguments. What should the, and we're assuming nothing has changed. It's just a typical COVID and flu and cold and all that stuff. How should an average Catholic just who doesn't have any medical knowledge, doesn't have any expertise, what should he say to that accusation?
Well, you have to have a little bit of medical knowledge to be able to know that, okay, look, you're arguing for a set of assumptions, right? That one, I could be completely well and yet spreading this invisible virus. What reason do you have for thinking that's true? If that's true, why wouldn't that be true for everything else? Because there's dozens of viruses getting spread around. So why would not that prevent me from ever going to Mass? Right. And that's always been the problem, is that the justification for this, if it really held, would justify us never leaving the house, because there's always some non-zero threat that we're posing whenever we leave the house. And so it needs to be something really realistic. And so that's the kind of the reality, though, is that, look, if I can kill somebody unbeknownst to me through no fault of my own, not doing anything other than what I would normally do, then why would I ever get to leave the house? And no one ever has a response to that. No, it's always, well, this is really deadly, or something, right? They have to appeal to some presumed scientific fact. And so, I mean, I think that's ultimately going to be the reality of it. If people can asymptomatically spread disease all around, and therefore we have to restrict ourselves and prevent ourselves from leaving the house, no one can ever leave the house. That's what makes this so crazy. And instead, we need to accept the fact that we are social beings, and there's always some kind of non-zero probability and some risk that all of us assume by going out into the world. But if we don't have any good reason to think we're sick with a deadly disease, if I'm sick with a respiratory virus, I'm not going to Mass and coughing on people, obviously, right? And so we use the basic moral sort of categories that we had at the beginning before any of this happened, the basic common sense, and we return to the old normal.
Yeah, I remember when during the winter at one point, I'm pretty sure, I never got tested, but I'm pretty sure I got COVID because I couldn't smell or taste anything for a while. So I was like, I probably have it. So, but I didn't have, and I was a little bit under the weather, but I was like, okay, I'm just not going to go to Mass because, like, you know, I'm sick. I would do this if I had the flu and I had these same symptoms. I wouldn't go because I wouldn't want to get other people sick. So it's like just common sense stuff that we were doing before the public health officials told us all this stuff. Now, what would you say then? Okay, so let's say there's an attempt at this again. What can Catholics do to, other than sending your book to their pastor and bishop, what can they do to, because like you mentioned, there was no protest, really.
Right.
No, what can they do to protest this? I mean, I know of a woman who literally, she just kept on harassing the chancery until she got a meeting with the bishop. She had a meeting. She told them, you got to open up the churches. We got to, you know, stop mm-hmm. preventing people from all this stuff. And of course, nothing happened, but God bless her. I mean, she did her duty, but I think she was probably the only one in her diocese that did it. So what should Catholics do if this starts to come down the pike? It looks like we're going to start shutting things down again.
Well, what should happen is that lots of influential Catholics in every diocese immediately do that. They immediately go to the bishop and say, look, we need to sue, if it's the city or the state, we need to sue the governor. And they're all these politicians are out over their skis on these constitutional issues. They almost always lost. Most of them have emergency powers that last about 30 days. They're way out beyond their authority. And the problem was that no one really challenged them in most places. Every diocese instead should immediately challenge this. And then, you know, the point is, make a point of disincentivizing the politicians from doing this, and then study the issue and figure out, okay, what's a predictable response for ourselves? But we're not going to accept that just, you know, a politician always just appealed to public health to shut down mass. We should not concede that territory under any circumstances.
Yeah, and the problem, of course, we've already conceded it. I think one thing that was done brilliantly by my own governor, diabolically but brilliantly, is that he knew the constitutional issues. And so he never, all his mandates never always gave a religious exemption, but the bishops were like, okay, we're going to show ourselves to be good citizens by going along with this. And voluntarily, I mean, they were going to be bully pulpit if they didn't, but voluntarily deciding to shut everything down. So I think that is where, if lay Catholics were telling them, and priests hopefully were telling the bishop, no, we don't want this. We want to go to mass. I mean, I think it would have been nice if, like, all these churches, like the cathedrals that were shut down, everything, if we had been outside of those, just like praying. I mean, it doesn't have to be some like crazy protest, but just praying in front of all these, like, you know, during mass times, you go to 9:30 mass, you show up at 9:30 right outside the door. And if all of a sudden there's hundreds of people doing this, a message does get sent at some point.
It does, and there's actually no way to enforce it. I mean, the reality is that all of these, the mask mandates, the lockdown mandates, they were only enforceable because for the most part, we complied. If an entire hamlet or township of 500 homes, everybody just decided they were not going to wear masks, right? Well, who's going to enforce that? What, are they going to arrest 500 families? That's not going to happen. They relied upon our own fear, either genuine fear of disease or just fear of, you know, kind of social opprobrium in order to enforce these things. And so we need to be less compliant. I'm not saying be violent. I'm saying be less compliant, illogical and absurd appeals to these things in the future.
That's one of the reasons, like, my wife and I, we just didn't wear masks when we went out, even though during the mask mandates. Yeah. And it was mostly a message. Yeah, it's not a big deal to wear a mask. I get that. But it was mostly what you're saying is because we wanted to create friction so that the companies are like, I don't really, you know, I don't want to deal with it. The employees don't want to deal with it. The companies don't want to deal with it. And then there's pressure put on, like, people just aren't complying with this, and it becomes a dead letter, even if they keep it on the books. And I think the same thing here with Catholics is just doing what we can. There's only so much we can do. Obviously, we're not priests. We can't all of a sudden, you know, confect the sacraments or anything like that. But we can pray outside the churches. We can show up at the chancery, talk, you know, demand meetings with the bishop, things like that. That is our right as lay Catholics. Okay, so where can – I think that covers most of this. I mean, we could spend hours, I know, but you know, for the high level, the keeping it under an hour covering of it.
Yes.
Where can people find – your work, particularly on the COVID issue, but just also all the work that you're doing on all these different things that you've been involved in?
Actually, so follow me on Twitter at Dr. J. Richards, and then, of course, actually look at the stream. So we wrote, continued to write a lot on this, actually, at the stream. So William Briggs, Douglas Axe, and J. Richards. And so we try to keep track of this. Now it's been really tracking the vaccine more than anything as the lockdowns are ending. But I think that we should treat this as a learning opportunity so that at least we can prevent this stuff from happening in the future.
And what's your handle on Twitter?
It's Dr. J. Richards, so Dr. Dr. J. Richards, straight out.
And I'll link to that in the show notes. Let me write that down. So people can follow you there. And also William Briggs, he's an entertaining follow.
Yes, he is. He's I think he's at Fame Celebrity, and you'll find him when he's not, hasn't been suspended. Yeah.
Right. I was gonna say, he kind of regularly just goes through suspension.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. Well, thank you very much for being on, Dr. Jay Richards. His book, The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. I think, was that the first one that was really, that came out, was really anti the COVID response?
Yeah, it really was. And it's just because we worked on it during the lockdowns, effectively. And we had Regnery as a publisher, and they're just amazing about turning things around. So we got it out in early October.
And one of the great, one of the things is, a lot of times the rapid response books about whatever's happening, they mm-hmm. within a month or two, they're just no longer really valid anymore. But the nice thing about yours and reading yours is like, no, this was written as a, okay, for the future. It's like, we're talking about what just happened, but we're actually saying for the future, the response, this is why the response was bad, so that later we don't have the same response. So people might think it came out real quick, and it really though, and it's a couple months old, it came out in October, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So October, it's still, it is valid today as it was then. And it's kind of one of these perennial things we can always look to as a reference when they try to shut us down again. So, so thank you and your co-authors for writing that. Okay, so everybody who is watching, please, or listening, please like and subscribe. Tell your friends about the podcast. We'd love to have more and more people watching and listening. We'll try to keep having great guests like Dr. Richards on. Jay, thank you very much for being on. God bless your work. And congratulations again for joining the Heritage Foundation. Looking forward to everything you're going to do with them as well.
Great to be with you, Eric.
Okay, everybody. Until next time, God love you.